A quick heads up, this episode includes mention of substance and domestic abuse.
There will also be some strong language. Please be advised.
It's 1981 in Los Angeles, California, and 6-year-old Drew Barrymore is sitting in the waiting area of a large office. The energetic young girl has bright, blonde hair and striking green eyes. Across from her sits another little blonde girl around the same age. And to her left is yet another blonde girl, also the same age.
Sounds like she's at Oak Hill Elementary in Severna Park, Maryland.
You've really held on to that, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the whole room is filled with angelic little blonde girls. And all of them are here to audition for the same role. This is a casting call, and it's a big one. Director Steven Spielberg is looking for a fresh young actress to star in his latest film. Drew's here because she's lonely and desperately craving attention. Her divorced parents are both actors, and neither of them is around very much. Drew's dad is in and out of her life. Mostly out. So Drew's mom works all the time to provide for them. During the day, she goes to auditions. And at night, she pulls double shifts waiting tables. Poor Drew's basically being raised by a revolving door of teenage babysitters. Mostly, they ignore her too and spend evenings on the phone with their boyfriends. Drew wants to see what it's like to have all eyes on her. Just her. She wants to feel special and maybe even make her mom and dad proud by landing this role. But it's hard to feel special sitting next to so many near-identical doppelgangers. Just then, the door to Spielberg's office opens. The casting associate calls out, "Drew Barrymore?" Drew takes a deep breath and squeaks, "That's me." Inside the office sits the movie's director, Steven Spielberg. He's 35 and scruffy with a full beard and thick-rimmed glasses. By now, he's heard the same lines 100 times from too many girls to count. But when Drew starts her audition, he perks up. Drew is witty and exuberant. Even in her tiny frame, she seems to take up the whole room with her magnetic personality. Spielberg can tell he's met a future star. When she finishes, he looks at Drew and says, "Sorry, I don't think you're right for this role." Drew won't be starring in Poltergeist.
Okay, rude. I thought this was an audition for E.T.
I mean, it's called building suspense, Arisha. I'm making a meal out of this.
Right, right.
Take note. But Spielberg does ask her to come back and audition for another role he thinks she'd be perfect for. And it's for a project that he's even more passionate about. Spielberg's right about Drew's spark. She has a presence that America's gonna fall in love with. But as Drew will soon discover, fame can often be less of a blessing and more of a curse. Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank?
Literally always.
Okay, well, the new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look, and it comes in luxe gold packaging. It feels incredibly high-end, but it is a lot more affordable.
Oh yeah, the Panorama Mascara lives up to its name by giving your lashes panoramic volume and a fully fanned-out look. Its tapered mascara wand catches every single lash, including those hard-to-reach corner lashes. When I do wear makeup, I do the bare minimum, and that's usually eyeliner and mascara and lip gloss.
Yeah.
And so mascara has to really pop.
Yes.
And let me tell you, L'Oreal, this baby pops.
Yeah. I do love the packaging. Like, I'm all about that.
So if you're looking for an affordable mascara that gives you voluminous, lengthened lashes, you can buy the Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. This episode is brought to you by Saks.com.
We know you have your tried and true closet staples, but it can be fun to switch it up. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada.
Yeah, it's easy to find instant inspiration at Saks.com. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch.
Okay, well, obviously this is making me just want to shop after we record this.
I know. And it doesn't take much for me wanting to shop.
No.
So. But if you're looking for a joyful shopping escape, which we all are,
yes,
then head to Saks.com for inspiring ways to shop for everything on your agenda.
Saks.com.
Saks.com.
From Wondery, I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams.
And this is Even the Rich, where we bring you absolutely true and absolutely shocking stories about the biggest celebrities the world has ever seen.
It's a show about power, how you get it, how you keep it, and what happens when you nearly lose it all.
It's also about how the rich are just like us, because even the rich fall in love and break up and struggle
and go to Studio 54 parties at 9 years old.
So, Arisha, when I say Drew Barrymore, what comes to mind?
I mean, absolute rom-com classics.
Mm-hmm.
Ever After, Josie Grossi and Never Been Kissed, An Angel of Charlie. Should I go on?
I mean, I'm upset that you're leaving out The Wedding Singer because I think that's probably my favorite Drew movie.
You know how I feel about The Wedding Singer.
No, I don't.
We just talked about this. I don't like it. I know.
Oh my God.
We got to end this whole show.
I got to post a casting for a new co-host. But also, I'd like to revisit the time that I met Drew Barrymore working at Chelsea Handler's house. And can I just say, she was truly one of the nicest celebrities I have ever met. She was so sweet.
Yeah. I mean, she's a friend of Chelsea Handler's, who's also way cool.
Yes.
It makes sense.
Yeah. She, like, waved to us from her car. I'm like, oh, my God, you're so sweet.
She waved at you. That's all it takes in this day and age.
Yeah. She's an absolute gem. And I think it's safe to say that she's really got her shit together these days. But that was not always the case. She's battled some serious demons. And a lot of them can be traced back to her famous family. The Barrymores were some of the most successful and revered performers of their generation. But they were also plagued by tragedy. Despite their charisma and talent, the Barrymore family was volatile, addictive, and prone to self-destructive behavior. And Drew was no exception. Over the next four episodes, we're telling you the story of one lonely little girl's meteoric rise to fame, her rapid downward spiral, and how she escaped the curse of her family's misfortune, all by the age of 14. But to understand how Drew had to fight to build stability in her life, we've got to start the story a little further back. This is episode one, The Barrymore Curse. It's 1874, and Herbert Arthur Chamberlain Blythe is ready to start his new life in America. Herbert's 25, and he's having what we might call a midlife crisis. Instead of becoming a barrister the way his father always planned, he's left London to pursue a career in acting. To spare his scandalized father's feelings, he's planning to take a stage name. But not even that is enough to stop dear old dad from cutting him off. Herbert's always liked the name Maurice, especially the French pronunciation with the accent on the last syllable.
Ah, il s'appelle Maurice.
Any excuse for you to speak in a French accent?
You're damn right.
So nobody else can seem to get it right. No one else is you, apparently. And eventually, he leans into it and stops correcting them. For his last name, he gets his inspiration from the late actor William Barrymore. It's a solid name. He feels like it commands respect. So with that, Herbert Blythe says a final goodbye to his old life and an enthusiastic hello to his new adventures as Maurice Barrymore. Now he's just got to get his new name up in lights. It turns out becoming a star isn't exactly hard for the man now known as Maurice Barrymore. Maurice is charming and witty. And of course, it helps that he's very attractive. He has dark hair, a sharp nose, captivating gray eyes, and a dignified cleft in his chin. Almost as soon as he lands in New York, Maurice meets a producer who thinks he has what it takes to be a leading man. One moment, Maurice is some random guy with a dream. The next, he's starring in a play on Broadway. And the audience loves him, especially the ladies. But he's not just a pretty face. Maurice gets rave reviews for his performance, and people start taking notice. Suddenly, his career is taking off. And being beloved has its perks, like a new girl in his bed every night. Maurice is more than happy to soak up the benefits of being a young, handsome bachelor with his star on the rise. So falling in love is the last thing on his mind. It's 1875 in New York City, and Maurice is heading into a special rehearsal of the play Peek. Georgie Drew is joining the cast, and they need to get her up to speed. Maurice has heard all about Georgie. She comes from a family of actors who own and operate the Arch Street Theater in Philadelphia. Maurice has earned the respect of the theater community with his performances. But the Drew family's reputation precedes them. That name carries serious weight in the theater world.
I love a fresh cup of nepotism in the morning.
Same, I'm jealous of it. When Georgie enters the room, it's like all the air goes out of Maurice's lungs. His knees go weak. He can't stop staring at her golden curls and bright blue eyes. He's smitten, and the feeling is mutual. Georgie can't seem to tear her eyes away from him either. The entire cast can see that these two have a spark. On New Year's Eve, 1876, 27-year-old Maurice and 20-year-old Georgie tie the knot. By 1878, they welcome their first child, Lionel. Baby Ethel comes the following year, and shortly after that, their son Jack is born. The bright young upstart marrying into a respected artistic family drives the theater community wild. With their combined star power, Maurice and Georgie basically become a power couple. People line the streets to see them star together in plays.
So Maurice and Georgie walked so Brooke and Arisha could run.
You know what? I was hoping that was going there, and you didn't disappoint. Unfortunately, all that fame means the Barrymore kids don't see a lot of their parents. Maurice and Georgie are away on tour so often that their children see them as glamorous strangers. And honestly, that might have been for the best, because mom and dad don't exactly set the best example for their kids. Lionel, Ethel, and Jack often catch their father stumbling home drunk in the early hours of the morning. When he spots them, Maurice tells them not to be scared because staggering is a sign of strength.
Yeah, strength of the alcohol.
Yeah. The kids hear their parents argue often, too, mostly about Maurice's infidelity. He cheats on Georgie constantly. And even though she threatens to leave him, she never does. Plus, Maurice is terrible with money and spends his earnings as soon as he gets them. The bigger the paycheck, the bigger the purchases. Things aren't going great, and the bills are starting to pile up. To make things worse, in 1893, Georgie gets very, very sick. She has tuberculosis, and she's getting worse by the day.
Oh no, just like poor Satine in Moulin Rouge.
Exactly. Georgie heads to Santa Barbara with 13-year-old Ethel to recover, but the children are never told what's really wrong. Ethel only figures out the truth when she overhears her mother crying. She learned pretty early how to pretend everything is okay when it's not. So that's what she does. Ethel is by her mother's side when Georgie dies at 36. And Maurice puts her in charge of coordinating the funeral arrangements.
The only thing I was arranging at 13 was my crushes in order of cuteness.
And it's very sad nothing's changed.
Okay, well.
And yeah, it's a pretty big dick move by Maurice. And it forces Ethel to grow up really fast. Because without Georgie's income, the family's finances go from terrible to tragic. Maurice sells their house and all their possessions just to make ends meet. And now the Barrymore children have to get to work too, because it's the only way they'll be able to eat. 6 months after Georgie's death, Maurice remarries and focuses on his new, younger wife. His children find out about the nuptials in a newspaper announcement. Ethel has been the one supporting the family through her budding acting career. Even now, her father is terrible with money. But none of the children could have predicted just how bad things would actually get. It's March 28th, 1901. And a haggard Maurice Barrymore is returning to the stage. He's supposed to be reciting a poem, but when he opens his mouth, what comes out is much less pleasant. Instead of the poem, Maurice goes on an anti-Semitic rant about Jewish theater producers blacklisting actors and hoarding money.
Okay, who is this guy, Mel Gibson?
Never heard of him.
Gross.
But yeah, it's gross. And even worse, the audience just laughs. They think it's part of a performance piece. For a while now, there have been rumors that Maurice's behavior is getting erratic. He's been spotted roaming the streets looking disheveled, and once he even showed up to a rehearsal wearing pajamas, which was very ahead of his time.
I was gonna say.
Maurice has always been eccentric, but now things are escalating. In one production, he stabs a co-star in the hand during a sword fighting scene. He secretly removed the guard that keeps the weapon safe for the actors. Thankfully, the guy was not seriously injured. After the poetry incident, Maurice spends the next few days in a deluded frenzy, spouting more conspiracy theories. Ethel and Jack are forced to intervene. They get a temporary restraining order and commit him to the psych ward at Bellevue. Jack is still a teenager, but he's the one who escorts his father to the hospital. As it turns out, Maurice has syphilis.
Okay, this is just like that episode of SVU where the guy goes on a killing spree because he had untreated syphilis.
Okay, do you get a kickback from Law & Order every time you mention them on one of these
Trying
shows?
To. Why do you think I keep mentioning it? My God, I wish they'd take a hint.
Well, yeah, so Maurice has had syphilis for years, and it spread to his brain. His condition is so bad that the doctors at Bellevue recommend he be transferred to a permanent asylum on Long Island. But Ethel and Jack still have to get him there, and Maurice refuses to go. Thinking fast, Ethel tells her father there's a driver waiting to take him to a theater for a performance. Jack coaxes him into the car and gets his father safely to the asylum. For the next 4 years, Maurice's condition continues to deteriorate. He becomes obsessed with writing a new play he insists will be a masterpiece. When he finally reveals his manuscript, it's just one sentence typed over and over again for 100 pages.
Honestly, though, it's probably better than my script, which just has "something funny here" written for every other line.
Wait, do you write the Even the Rich scripts?
Sick one.
Oh, man. So actually, the sentence was, "It was a lovely day in June." And I have no idea what it means. When Maurice dies in 1905, Ethel once again steps up to collect his body, plan the funeral, and pay the bills. She goes on stage right after his service. But Jack is still the baby of the family, and he doesn't cope nearly as well as his big sister. His father's death triggers a flood of guilt, and he only knows one way to deal with difficult feelings: self-destruct.
So as a listener of Even the Rich, you know that audio piques the imagination, which is why we're so excited for Audible's new collection of exclusive thrillers. They feature captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances that really bring the story to life.
Oh, yeah. The next listen on my list is the psychological thriller, The Silent Patient.
Ooh.
So it's all about a therapist who tries to unravel the mystery of a woman who refuses to talk or give any explanation as to why she shot her husband. I mean, it's going to be the perfect binge listen, and you know I love my thrillers.
I can agree. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog.
Yeah, new members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500.
That's audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500 to get started.
Life is busier than ever. It might be harder to find time these days to grocery shop, prep, and cook healthy and hearty meals. I get it, but Factor's got you covered.
Yeah, so Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, delivered right to your door, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes.
Exactly. And Factor is tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. If you're traveling or still finishing up last week's meals, you can always pause or reschedule deliveries.
I mean, I know I've talked before about how much I love Factor because it's just so easy.
And it doesn't taste like, you know, the microwavable meals you see, especially in rom-coms when we're trying to heighten and highlight how sad and pathetic this woman's life is.
Yeah.
They don't taste like that. They taste so good as if you made them yourself or hired a chef. Head to factormeals.com/rich50 and use code rich50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box. That's code rich50 at factormeals.com/rich50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It's 1901, and Jack Barrymore is 19 years old. Jack is slender with brown hair and his mother's blue eyes. But his long, sharp nose and cleft chin make it clear he's his father's son. Jack is outgoing and charismatic, but he isn't as responsible as his older siblings. As a child, he was always getting into trouble. He constantly got into fights at school.
Apple meet tree.
Truly. But unfortunately, Jack has a reason for acting out so often. When he's 14 years old, his father's second wife molests him.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
I know. The abuse really affects Jack. His drinking goes into overdrive, and he becomes very distrustful of women. He spends his nights at bars and his mornings creeping out of different women's beds. Bit by bit, Jack morphs into a shadow of his famous father. But unlike Maurice, Jack hasn't found his passion. He's not even sure if he wants to act. Thankfully, his big sister sees potential in him, and she doesn't plan to let it go to waste without a fight. It's February 1906 in New York City, and Jack is in a new play at the Criterion Theater. They're several months into the show's run, so things are going smoothly. Jack only has a small part, but Ethel fought for him to get it. She begged the producer to add him to the cast. Ethel insists her baby brother is the real deal when it comes to acting, but Jack is not so sure. What he is sure about is that he needs to clean up his act. He said yes to this job, hoping it would help him do just that. And so far, so good. Jack's been getting rave reviews for his performance, and it feels good. But tonight, he's not really in the mood. On stage in front of the audience, Ethel walks over to a chair and rests her hands on its high back. That's Jack's cue to enter stage left. But a moment goes by. Then another. No Jack. Ethel squints at the wings and ad-libs some dialogue, trying to buy her brother some time to hit his mark. But right now, Jack is indisposed. When the frantic stage manager bursts into his dressing room to rush him to the stage, he finds Jack sprawled out on the floor, naked and drunk.
Sounds like a case of be-hosting even the rich.
Yeah, if it were today, he'd be on Instagram.
Yeah.
And poor Ethel is getting desperate. She tries to stall, saying things like, "Here he comes. He's walking up the path now." Finally, a tall figure steps on stage. But it's not Jack. It's the stage manager in Jack's costume. Ethel is furious. She knows immediately what's happened, and she wants to wring her brother's neck. But the show must go on, and Jack isn't going to change until he wants it for himself. And right now, change does not seem to be at the top of Jack's list of priorities. He continues to show up to rehearsals late and drunk. You'd think it would put him on a do-not-hire list, but despite his erratic behavior and lack of commitment, Jack has managed to gain quite a following. Female patrons swoon when he's on stage.
Like a regular old Chris Evans.
Yep, totally. Jack's issues make him a production liability, but he fills seats. So he keeps getting parts. His natural charm plays perfectly in comedies, which we know everything about. In fact, between his good looks and his effortless charisma, he might just be perfect for the big screen. It's 1914, the dawn of the silent movie era. With his broad appeal, Jack easily makes the jump from stage to screen. Right now, he's starring in a romantic comedy called An American Citizen, and he's loving it. For starters, the movie is silent, so he doesn't have any lines to learn. He can spend his nights drinking instead of trying to get off book. All he has to do on screen is pantomime. He's expressive with his actions and his face, and his features pop off the screen. Jack is an instant hit, so he signs on to do 3 more comedies. They all get good reviews. And one of them, The Incorrigible Duquesne, is even considered one of the best films of 1915. With all that praise for very little work, Jack figures, why not do 3 more? but he quickly regrets that decision. His next three films are abysmal. In a review of his film, The Red Widow, Variety shreds his performance and mocks his mugging and slapstick methods. And Jack can't really disagree. He even calls it the worst film ever made.
Well, lucky for Jack, the movie Cats came along.
Lucky for Jack, a lot of movies came along. But after that embarrassment, something inside Jack shifts. He knows he's been slumming it, and he wants to do better. So he returns to his home, the theater. And this time, he's determined to prove he's got that famous Barrymore talent. It's November 16th, 1922 in New York City, and it's Jack's opening night. As the audience bustles in, he's standing on stage waiting for the curtains to open. With his slicked back hair, long black tunic, black tights, shoes, and cape, he's transformed himself into one of Shakespeare's most famous characters, Hamlet. Since he decided to become a serious actor, Jack's really committed. Reviews always dinged him for his voice, so to prep for this role, he spent months sequestered away with a vocal coach. He even moves into her home and refuses to agree to a premiere date until he thinks he's ready.
And her family's like, "Mom, who's this man that keeps coming to breakfast?"
Yeah. Now, when the show begins, Jack's ready to show off what he's learned. He looks out into the audience and speaks his first line. "Who's there?" The audience watches in awe as Jack transforms into Hamlet. Nothing even remotely slapstick. He enunciates every syllable with perfect diction. And as Jack continues, he can feel the audience's energy buzzing all around him. Something electrifying is happening. He can feel it. Jack's performance in Hamlet rocks the theater world. One critic calls it an evening that will be memorable in the history of the American theater. The New York Times notes that the reading of the lines was flawless, an art that is said to have been lost. Jack stars in Hamlet for 101 performances, including once for the Pope. On the night of his last appearance, the theater's box office has to turn away more than 1,000 people. The role takes Jack from being famous to being a superstar. He accomplished exactly what he set out to do, and he's proud of it. But he's also completely burnt out. When he takes his final bow, Jack is happy to close the curtain on Hamlet and never set foot on stage again.
To be or not to be?
That is the question. He's one of the most in-demand actors in the world. He can do whatever he wants. And what he wants is a much less stressful gig. So he starts a podcast. Just kidding. Jack signs a three-picture deal with Warner Brothers and immediately makes them a profit. His first film for the studio, The Sea Beast, becomes the highest-grossing film of 1924. Then, rival studio United Artists notices and poaches him for their own three-picture deal, doubling the offer from Warner Brothers. With all that money, Jack starts living large, just like his father Maurice. He spends and spends. But he has more money than Maurice ever did. He buys 7 acres of land in the Hollywood Hills and erects a Spanish colonial mansion he names Bella Vista. It has 55 rooms, multiple swimming pools, and endless gardens.
Okay, but does it have an upstairs neighbor who belts out show tunes sporadically?
No, actually, Jack just does that himself. But the house is filled with all the distractions a rich man can buy. He can play tennis, shoot at his skeet range, or chill out in his opium den. But if Jack thought fame and fortune would chase away his demons, he's dead wrong. By 1934, Jack's been divorced twice and separated from his third wife. His drinking problem has been the thorn in each of his marriages. Jack cleaned up his act when he was working on Hamlet, but after he left the show, he fell off the wagon. His addiction also affects his relationship with his three kids, especially his son, John Drew Barrymore Jr. John is the youngest of Jack's kids, and he knows his father the least. At 10 years old, he claims he's only seen his father once in his entire life.
I bet the Jacksons wish they could say the same.
Mm-hmm. But I will say it's not like having Jack around would have been an improvement. John's older half-sister even writes a dishy tell-all book with truly unbelievable stories about their father. On one yacht vacation, he promised he'd stay sober. His family even had the crew make sure that there was no alcohol on board. But even though they were thorough, they were no match for Jack's alcoholism. Since he can't get his usual drink, he siphons off a pint of alcohol from the engine's cooling system.
Ugh. Where there's a will, there's a way, I guess.
Oh my God, truly. And it's awful. Jack's addiction is so severe, it's ruining his life. Everyone can see it. Later, Jack signs on to make a film called Dinner at 8. He plays a drunk, washed-up silent film star on the brink of physical and emotional ruin.
Well, at least this time he doesn't have to move in with his vocal coach.
Yeah, no, he just has to look in the mirror. And honestly, it's pretty bad. Let me play you a clip. This is his character's agent in the film speaking.
You're through in pictures and plays and vaudeville and radio and everything. You're a corpse.
Ironically, Dinner at 8 is one of Jack's best films. But given how much of the art imitates his life, it's also his most heartbreaking role. And Jack's state keeps declining. In one of his next films, he forgets his lines. The director gives him a break and postpones shooting so he can practice. But when the cameras start rolling again, Jack still can't do it. Production replaces him. He's unhirable. By the time he's in his 50s, Jack has gone from being the greatest actor alive to a washed-up has-been. He owes more on the mortgage for Bella Vista than it's worth, and he has to sell nearly everything he owns.
Thank God Facebook Marketplace wasn't around back then, or he'd be getting $8 for a whole swimming pool.
I mean, thank God the Buy Nothing group didn't exist, or you would have a house full of Jack shit. When Jack dies in 1942 at the age of 60, he has 60 cents to his name and $200,000 in debt. And his siblings barely do much better. Lionel transitions to film and wins an Oscar for Best Actor. But off-screen, a serious injury leads him to an opiate addiction he struggles with until his death at 76. Ethel works in theater across six decades and becomes the second Oscar winner in the family. But she also struggles with addiction and drinks heavily for years. She stops cold turkey at 60 and dies at 79. But even through their hardships and struggles, Lionel, Ethel, and Jack manage to outshine previous generations of their family. Together, they secure the Barrymore legacy as the royal family of the American stage. But a legacy like that can be a heavy crown to wear. That crown falls to Jack's youngest child, John Drew Barrymore. Like his father, he's an actor, but he quickly becomes more famous for what he's doing off-screen. By 1959, 29-year-old John has already been in and out of jail several times. He's even been charged with drunk driving, including a hit and run.
Okay, that's shitty. But if Hollywood's taught us anything, it's not something that'll hold you back.
Sadly true. There's also speculation that he abuses his wife, fellow actor Kara Williams. John and Kara have two kids together, but predictably, their marriage falls apart. With all the drama in his personal life, John is desperate to get his life back on track. So he heads for Italy, where they're churning out movies like candy. It's not about quality, it's about quantity. And John figures he can easily get parts in low-budget films. His instincts are right. And in the 5 years he's in Italy, John makes 16 films that even he isn't proud of. When he returns to L.A., he tells the press he's straightened himself out. Then he's arrested almost immediately for public drunkenness. Plus, he heads back to prison for possession of marijuana, which we all know how I feel about, as chronicled in our world-famous Dolly Parton reel. I tumble out of bed, I stumble to the kitchen, and I pack myself a bong of ambition. Mm-hmm. But John can't stop lying to himself or the press. In his next statement, he tells the world, "I'm not a nice, clean-cut American kid at all. I'm just a human being. Those things just happen. After that, John pretty much gives up. He stops trying to change. He's a rolling stone tumbling his way through life. He accepts that his addiction ended his career before it could really get started. He's never going to match the achievements of the last generation. He's inherited all their vices, but very little of their skill. The line of succession for the royal family of American theater might just end with him.
We all face stress in our daily lives. What if the answer to a better stress response is in one key nutrient? I'm talking about magnesium, and specifically Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers. This one-of-a-kind product is designed to reverse low levels of magnesium, which could have a positive effect on our stress response. But don't take my word for it. Here's a quote from a 2020 issue of the scientific journal Nutrients. Results suggest that stress could increase magnesium loss, causing a deficiency. And in turn, magnesium deficiency could enhance the body's susceptibility to stress, resulting in a magnesium and stress vicious circle. I only recommend Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers. It's the only organic full-spectrum magnesium supplement that includes 7 unique forms of magnesium for stress resilience and better sleep. Simply go to bioptimizers.com/ifstories. Promo code IFSTORIES10 to get your magnesium breakthrough and find out this month's gift with purchase. That's bioptimizers.com/IFSTORIES. Promo code IFSTORIES10.
When you find new ways to save, you can reach your financial goals more easily and still have the occasional treat.
Exactly. And Chime's here to help you do that. With a Chime checking account, you can make financial progress with features like fee-free overdraft up to $200 with SpotMe, or getting paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit.
Yep. So if you set up direct deposit into your Chime account and use an activated debit card, Chime will spot you up to your limit when you exceed your balance.
And I love that Chime never charges fees or interest for using SpotMe. To date, Chime has spotted members over $20 billion.
My God. Take more control of your finances and say goodbye to monthly fees. Open your account in minutes at chime.com/rich. That's chime.com/rich.
Chime feels like progress.
Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. members FDIC. SpotMe eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Boosts are available to eligible Chime members enrolled in SpotMe and are subject to monthly limits. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details. Mama.
It's 1971 in Los Angeles, and 40-year-old John is sitting at a table in the Troubadour. It's a music venue where on any given night, you could see James Taylor or The Doors perform. But when John locks eyes with one of the cocktail servers, it's as if time stops and the music fades into the background. Through the haze of cigarette smoke and bodies, John stares slack-jawed at Jade Mako. Jade is 25 and beautiful with long black hair. She came to LA to act, and John can't stop looking at her as she moves from table to table taking drink orders. And Jade notices him too. She keeps sneaking glances and she thinks he's extremely sexy. Their chemistry is palpable, so they start dating. And whenever they're together, it feels like things are about to explode, but not in a good way. John is physically and emotionally abusive, and things between the couple deteriorate quickly. Jade tries to leave over and over again, but John keeps charming her back. Jade just can't quit him. That is, until she realizes she's pregnant. As soon as she gets the news, it stops being about just her. Now she needs to leave to protect her baby. She tells John it's over. And this time, she means it. Jade packs a few things and checks into the Tropicana Motel. But John finds her and shows up. As they fight, John starts to kick her in the stomach.
What the fuck?
Luckily, some of the other guests hear her screaming and call the police. According to Jade, it took 5 policemen to get him off of her. And even after that disaster, John still tries to win her back. When Jade refuses, he retaliates by burning down their house.
Wow, paging Lisa Left Eye Lopez.
Mm-hmm. And no matter which way you look at it, their relationship is abusive and unhealthy. But one amazing thing does come out of it. On February 22nd, 1975, Jade Mako gives birth to a little girl she names Drew Blythe Barrymore. And even though she's cut John out of her life, she still wants their daughter to know she's part of a very important family. The baby's first name is from John's side of the family, the acting legends from Philadelphia, the Drews. Her middle name is for her great-grandfather, Maurice, who, if you remember, was originally born Herbert Blythe. But it'll be quite a while before baby Drew gets a real glimpse at the legacy she's inheriting. It's 1979 in Los Angeles, and 4-year-old Drew Barrymore is wearing a Mickey Mouse t-shirt and jeans. Her blonde hair is up in pigtails. She's sitting in the kitchen eating an avocado when a strange man appears in the doorway. He looks unkempt and unshaven. Drew's sure she's never met him before, but he's strangely familiar to her. When her mom enters the room in her work uniform and sees him, her face goes pale. She was expecting the babysitter, not this guy. Putting the pieces together, Drew calls out, "Daddy?" And she's right. It's John. He barges into their apartment as Jade screams at him to leave. Drew's eyes go wide and she shakes her head. She doesn't want him to go. She's dreamt of meeting her father, and now her mom is ruining it. But Jade is adamant. She yells at him that he's drunk and needs to leave. But John just tells her to stop and shoves her to the floor.
Wow, glad to see he's learned nothing in 4 years.
Nothing. John hovers over Jade and screams into her face. Drew panics. She doesn't know what to do. She just wants things to calm down. She wants her father to stay, but she also doesn't want her mother to get hurt. So Drew does the only thing she can think of. She wedges her little body between them. Without even thinking, John picks her up and throws her across the room.
Okay, they put this guy in prison for weed and not tossing his child across a room? What
yeah,
the fuck?
Seriously. Luckily, Drew lands in a laundry basket and onto a pile of clothes. If she hadn't, she could have been injured pretty badly. John knows he went way too far. So he turns around and leaves. In the aftermath, Drew sits completely stunned. She hasn't been physically injured, but the emotional wounds are definitely there. All Drew wants is for her parents to focus on her instead of fighting with each other. She just has to figure out how to make that happen. When Drew was 11 months old, she went to an audition for a Puppy Chow commercial. Out of the hundreds of kids there, she got saddled with a real Cujo of a dog. He bit her. But instead of crying, Drew threw her head back and laughed. It impressed everyone, and she landed the role. But the best part of the whole experience was all the attention. The casting director fawned all over her, and the director was obsessed. Her mother was thrilled. She made everyone happy. And now Drew wants to do that again. If she can work her magic and make her parents happy, then maybe they won't have to fight. They'll have time to pay attention to her.
She should just do what you do and break out in a song every once in a while.
Exactly. Makes total sense. Drew decides her mission is to break into Hollywood. And it's not quite so easy when you can't drive a car and you need your parents' permission. But Drew's got a special spark that lights up a room. And the minute she starts auditioning, casting directors take notice. Drew keeps landing commercials. And eventually, she does a feature film starring William Hurt. Her career is getting some real traction. But it's not until her next audition that she finds the role that will change the game. It's 1981, and 6-year-old Drew is back in the waiting area outside Steven Spielberg's office. This time, trying out for the role of little kid sister Gertie in his new sci-fi movie, E.T. the Extraterrestrial. And now Drew's seriously nervous. She knows this part is bigger than anything she's ever done before. It could change her life. Even though she's still young, she knows all you need is one big role to break in. All she has to do is swallow her nerves and ace this audition. Drew takes a deep breath and tells herself to go in there and knock it out of the park. She may feel nervous, but she's about to act confident. That's what she does best. The door opens and the same casting assistant appears. Drew Barrymore? Drew jumps up from her seat, pulls her face into a huge smile, and greets everyone in the room. She's buzzing with excitement. Spielberg asks her about herself. On the spot, she makes up a story about being in a punk rock band. She says they're called the Purple People Eaters.
Is this a casting call or an improv show?
Great question. But it does crack Spielberg up, so I guess improv show. This kid is a total spark plug. She's got imagination. And that's exactly what he's looking for in the role he's casting. E.T. is all about children and their ability to see beyond the ideas of closed-minded adults. There's just one more test he needs her to pass. Drew is standing in a sound room with Spielberg. Other members of the production team mill around as they prep for the test. He bends down to her level as her eyes roam over the padded walls. He tells her that he needs her to scream. Her character, Gertie, has a clutch scream moment when she first sees E.T. Drew nods her head. I got this. Spielberg gives the signal, and the tape starts rolling. Drew reaches deep down inside of herself and screams. She lets it rip, like really lets it rip. Drew screams so loud, she breaks the recording device.
Damn.
Everyone in the room is completely silent. They're staring at her. She freezes. Oh, crap. She was so confident, but now she's terrified. Did she just blow it? But when she looks over at him, a smile is creeping onto Spielberg's speechless face. He looks at her and says she's got the part. She's got the role of Gertie. Drew has no idea, but she's about to become a star before she makes it to first grade. She's going to receive more attention than she ever dreamed of and learn that being a celebrity comes with a lot of perks. But fame also comes with endless temptations. And without a strong hand to guide her, she'll make dangerous choices to avoid dealing with disappointment. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Even the Rich ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. This is episode one of our four-part series, Drew Barrymore, Rewriting the Story. We use many sources when researching our stories, including The Barrymores, Hollywood's First Family by Carol Stein Hoffman, Great Times, Good Times, The Odyssey of Maurice Barrymore by James Kotsilabis Davis, The House of Barrymore by Margot Peters, Too Much Too Soon by Diana Barrymore, and Little Girl Lost by Drew Barrymore. A quick note about our scenes. Some scripted dialogue has been added for narrative cohesiveness.
A quick reminder that our brand new Even the Rich merch store is live now. From cropped hoodies and comfy joggers to phone cases and champagne flutes, you can find it all at wonderyshop.com. And be sure to tell your friends.
I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams. Allison Reimer wrote this episode. Editing is by Julia Wolf. Our audio engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Sound design is by Sam Ada. Our coordinating producer is Matt Gant. And our managing producer is Tanja Thigpen. Kate Young and Rachel Engelman are our series producers. Our executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Jenny Lauer-Beckman, and Marsha Louie for Wondery.
Yeah. You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.